Hello, I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on Red River Radio. You know, winter is coming, and with it, many potential reasons to take extra care to avoid preventable illnesses that peak this time of year. These and other topics about respiratory illnesses and seasonal infectious disorders will be the focus of our discussion this evening, and in particular, the influenza virus. As you know, Health Matters is a live weekly show here on Red River Radio where our listeners can join this discussion. You can call and ask us questions at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet your question at RRR Public Radio. I'm going to go ahead and ask our guests to identify themselves, starting with the gentleman on my left.
Hi, I'm Dr. Himanshu Desai with Pulmonary Critical Care Specialist here in Shreveport.
And I'm Dr. Raymond Coughlin. I'm an infectious disease consultant at Willis-Knighton Health Center.
Dr. Joseph Polchini. I'm chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at LSU Shreveport. I'm an infectious disease specialist and a pediatrician.
Okay, so we have a pulmonary and critical care specialist here. We have an adult infectious disease specialist here as well as internal medicine specialist. And we have a pediatric specialist in both infectious diseases as well as pediatrics. Again, the number for your questions, it is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Polchini, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Always really great to talk to you. So when we think about the pediatric population this time of year, if you're a general pediatrician or if you're mom or dad out there, what are the things that people need to be concerned about this time of year, in particular regarding any sort of infectious problems?
Well, there are a number of respiratory viruses that cause upper respiratory infections and pneumonia, bronchiolitis that affect children that occur predominantly during the winter months. In addition, in the winter, we see influenza. And influenza is a particular problem for both children and adults, but for children, in any particular influenza season, somewhere from between 5 to 20% of all children will be infected by that strain of influenza. And that's why this is the one respiratory virus infection that we can prevent with vaccine. And that's why vaccination against influenza is so important every year.
So in the influenza vaccination, you know, a number of issues come up with vaccinations all the time. You know, one question that comes up is, you know, why are vaccines optional in some cases? And why are vaccines compulsory in other cases? And I know this may be a segue into public health somewhat, but from your perspective, is there really an option?
Well, for influenza, no, there's not an option. Everybody is at risk for influenza. It's a serious disease. It's an unpredictable illness, causes significant number of deaths every year in the United States, and even a larger number of hospitalizations. So the recommendation is that everybody 6 months of age and older get influenza vaccine every year. The reason some vaccines might be optional, it would be based on the fact that the entire general population is not at risk for that infection. And so it's really not optional. It's recommended for those people that may be at increased risk because of their occupation, because of their lifestyle, or because of travel to a country where a vaccine-preventable disease is rather than being in the United States. On the other hand, the recommended routine schedule is based on the fact that everybody has a risk for being exposed and infected with that organism.
All right. Thank you so much for that information. Dr. Desai, welcome back to Health Matters. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So many listeners are probably aware of the condition known as pneumonia. If you will, tell our listeners how to prevent pneumonia, maybe a little bit about what it is, and should they wait if they suspect they have it or seek earlier treatment? Because there are a lot of options to self-diagnose, a lot of opportunities to self-treat. There are a lot of medicines that are available at the counter. If you go to the cold section, let's say at a drugstore, there's probably 100 feet times four or five rows of medications that are available for the general population to self-diagnose and self-treat with. So when do people need to see a doctor like you if they have suspicion of a respiratory illness?
Well, people often take pneumonia as just some illness that can occur in the wintertime or even any time of year, and it may not be that serious. But it's important to know that pneumonia is still the eighth leading cause of death in the United States. So it is a pretty significant and serious disease that affects mortality and morbidity in the United States. It can be community acquired, and that's the pneumonia that we most common hear of. People in the community get pneumonia. They feel sick. Signs and symptoms are often fever, chills, night sweats, cough, sputum production. And the earlier you see a physician, the better it is. If you have those type of symptoms and you feel you have pneumonia, it's better to go see a physician earlier than later. Oftentimes, a primary care physician, your internal medicine doctor, or your pediatrician would be the first person to reach out to. In severe cases, pneumonia could get so severe that it may warrant hospitalization. And at that point, if you feel you're sick enough, you should go to the nearest emergency room.
And you talk about fever, chills, shortness of breath. Are there special populations that should, be on particularly high alert, such as maybe smokers or individuals with other medical conditions?
Well, I treat mainly adults. I don't do pediatrics. But in the adult population, certainly people that have pre-existing lung conditions, such as asthma, COPD, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, people that are immunocompromised, people that are smokers, those should be on high alert as well. Also the elderly, those older than age 65, people with higher BMI, actually, body mass index, are on high alert with those type of symptoms. So those people should seek. People with diabetes, those also are at higher risk, and those should seek help earlier rather than later.
And in many of these conditions, from what I remember in medical school, fever may be a symptom of late manifestations in terms of the severity of the illness.
Oftentimes when fever sets in, the disease has already progressed to the point where it may be a systemic problem, not just localized to the lungs. Yes, that's true.
All right, let's go ahead and take our first caller of the evening. We have Leon from Bossier. Leon, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, sir. I was curious about the comment about influenza. And I'm curious that I just finished an annual physical, and I got flu shot and pneumonia shot, and wondered if influenza and flu are similar, or are they the same?
Leon, that's a really good question. I'm going to ask Dr. Coughlin to go ahead, and we haven't heard from him yet tonight, and let's see if he can explain the difference between influenza and the pneumonia shot, and maybe the flu as well.
The question's absolutely fabulous, and I congratulate you for receiving it, and your physician for giving the vaccines. Influenza, I won't go into the historical names, but they do have influenza and other germs, if we will. We lump them all together and call them germs. Influenza is a virus, and most pneumonias are caused by bacteria. So you use an antibiotic to treat the bacterial disease once it's found to be pneumonia. And influenza is a respiratory disease that may lead to pneumonia, which is, it's very uncommon for it to do so, and there's a very high risk of dying should you get pneumonia from the influenza virus. But again, you can treat influenza. However, it's best to prevent influenza, and you should not. Again, we'll just suggest that you should not get an antibiotic for influenza unless you get what we call a secondary infection with a bacteria. But you definitely need antibiotics for a bacterial pneumonia. It's up to the physician to try and sort out what is the actual cause of the pneumonia, but most, again, it's going to require an antibiotic, whereas influenza should be prevented. Now, you receive two vaccines. One is to prevent a virus, and the other one is to prevent a pneumonia caused by a streptococcus, called Streptococcus pneumoniae, but it's called a pneumonia shot for that very reason.
So there's a very little similarity between a flu shot and influenza?
Influenza or a flu shot for influenza. The pneumonia shot, which you alluded to, is for bacterial pneumonia. Now, does that help you?
Just trying to separate the difference between the flu shot and influenza.
Okay, the flu shot is to prevent influenza, the viral disease.
Ah.
Okay, and the so-called pneumonia shot, which may be a misnomer, but is to prevent a bacterial disease caused by, again, a streptococcus pneumonia.
Yeah, Leon,
okay,
could we
say that a flu shot is the same as an influenza shot?
No, mm-hmm. We can say they're both vaccines, but they're to prevent two different disease types.
So do I need to go back to him and get an influenza shot?
No, Leon. The flu is sort of a common term for the disease that the influenza virus causes. And so for some reason, we don't say influenza vaccine. We say flu shot. It would be sort of saying a polio shot or a mumps shot or a measles shot. So it's just a semantic difference more than anything else, I think. From what I understand, Dr. Coughlin's saying is you should be taken care of from the standpoint of prevention of both the influenza illness or the illness of pneumonia caused by the streptococcus that he was discussing.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to have...
No, absolutely no need to apologize because I'm sure...
Because of my ignorance.
No, there's none there whatsoever. It's a common, probably a very common... misconception, and doctors are really good at confusing the general public about the names of diseases and so forth. So we're glad that you called, and congratulations on getting your vaccinations this year.
Thank you so much for y'all's participation and spread of knowledge. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
Let's go to John from Nacogdoches.
Hello?
Hello, John. You're on Health Matters.
Yes. Thanks for having me on the air. When I was 19, I was living in Chicago, and I was walking around during a hard winter in Chicago, and I guess I was walking around for like 2 months with gradually increasing walking pneumonia. And I ended up in Arizona working on the roof of a studio, making a roof. And then I got off the roof and got down the ladder and totally collapsed. I was very lucky because I was on the ground when I collapsed. And I really, during the whole time, I just had sniffles and slight pressure in my chest. I really wasn't aware that I was getting weaker and weaker and weaker, and it was really a strange experience. I had lost some weight, and the first time I went to the doctor in Arizona, he didn't detect any pneumonia, and so I after a week I collapsed again. I went there again, and he detected something in my lungs and said I had walking pneumonia. And so I went through the whole penicillin thing in bed, and the doctor said it was very serious, and that I nearly died, and I was there for a couple of weeks. And then after I got out, He said, see, your lungs are clear and everything. And he said, well, you can go home now. And so I went back to work, you know, in Chicago about a week afterwards, feeling not full of energy, but, you know, good enough to work. And that really was the point that ruined my health more than the pneumonia, I think. That the doctor didn't actually tell me how much a full recovery is important, you know. And so for I was going for about a month working very hard, and after that, it seems like it took like 7 years for my body to get back in shape, you know, to where it was. So I just want you to maybe stress how important it is for recovery after pneumonia rather than the pneumonia itself. I maybe it's just that one doctor, but you know that's my point.
John, really good topic. Excellent, excellent description of what your experience was with that illness. I'm going to go ahead and get our panelists to weigh in on maybe educating the public about what Dr. Desai. What is walking pneumonia? Is there such a thing?
Well, pneumonia is most often caused by bacteria, but pneumonia can also be caused by viruses, as Dr. Coughlin referred to or alluded to. It could also be caused by different things, like even fungus. We see fungal pneumonias especially in the Mississippi River Valley. Walking pneumonia is something that people have used that term often with patients. Doctors have used that term often with patients. There is no such thing as a typical walking pneumonia. In this young gentleman's case, he was probably had pneumonia all along, and because he was 19 and had such reserve as a young, robust 19-year-old, he just thought he had a cold and went through it, or he had a viral pneumonia at that time that wasn't severe until the point where it got to become almost septic, where it may have seeped into his bloodstream or escaped the lungs, and then he became extremely ill, and that's what happened. Of course, listen to your physicians when you get ill, especially when you require hospitalization, and listen to your body. Your body will tell you when you're ready to go back and do what you are normally able to do. But certainly, convalescing from pneumonia or any type of illness is quite important.
I think you brought up many, many good points. First of all, that as Dr. Desai said, you're a strapping 19-year-old, and what happened then was you reached a tipping point, or your body reached a tipping point with a degree of disease and pneumonia. The bacteria and the reaction to the bacteria occupies your lung space, and so you can't breathe, and whether you passed out because you were at that point or not. But you could have also been septic, as Dr. Desai said as well, that it could have been in your bloodstream at the time. But I think that those of us who have actually had pneumonia, I think, understand what you're saying about the overall fatigue and lethargy, the weakness that you feel when you're trying to recover. And it's very individual, so it may take some people a short time, but a long time in many cases, like yourself. The other part is, after pneumonia, you can get a sort of, not a rebound pneumonia, I don't want you to misinterpret what I'm saying, but some people will get wheezing after pneumonia sometime, and it isn't pneumonia, it's what we call it's a reaction to the pneumonia later on, once it's cured. And you can, like, say you take up exercise, and I'm not sure how you were when you were back at work, but if you go into jogging or swimming or you try exercise, once you think you've totally healed from pneumonia, you can get this reactive airway disease that feels like it's coming back sometimes. But that's a reason to go back to your doctor and have them take a look. You know, we all, especially at 19 or 20, we all think we can just bounce back and run back into the work, and most of the time your body has the reserves to do that. So I would think that, again, you brought up some great points, and I hope you have a better understanding of what really happened to you.
John, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Desai, you know, from the standpoint of recovery, and part of the question was about recovery, is there a chance that a severe bout of pneumonia can cause, you know, permanent lung damage, if you will?
Absolutely. It is important to know when we speak of pneumonia, what we're talking about. Pneumonia is, in fact, inflammation of the lungs. That's, you know, pneumonitis, which is itis meaning inflammation, and pneumonia meaning lung, the pneumo meaning lung. So you have a severe inflammation of usually one lobe or multiple lobes of the lung, depending on how severe the pneumonia is. Pneumonia in its most severe form can progress to a point where it can lead to things like sepsis, where it seeps out of your lungs into your bloodstream and it goes into a systemic inflammatory response in your body. It can also lead to something called adult respiratory distress syndrome, where you have severe scarring of your lungs from the infection. And if that happens, you can have permanent disability and permanent loss of lung function that could take years to come back to normal or may never come back to normal. It is very important to, if you have a bout of pneumonia that is severe and certainly that requires hospitalization, it is very important to have routine follow-up with your primary care physician or a pulmonologist or infectious disease doctor or whoever the doctors that are taking care of you, and let them know what you're feeling and what you're going through, because they can't help you unless they know.
And, you know, we know that the body is able to heal itself, but certain organs, you know, the brain is notorious for once you lose a section of the brain, there may be some rewiring, but you're not going to grow nerve cells back, at least as far as we know. So, you know, the spaces in the lung, the alveoli, those don't come back. If you lose those, right?
No, they don't come back.
From an infection or surgery, for example, you're not going to grow more, unlike, say, the liver. The liver will regrow, but you lose lung function, you lose these, you know, gas exchange units, you're not going to get them back, right?
Right. You don't get them back, but it is important to realize that if you have an acute bout of pneumonia, at that point, if I measured your lung function, clearly your lung function would be diminished. Once you recover from the lung the pneumonia and the inflammation in your lungs, your lung function may be better than it was when you were acutely ill. So just because you feel, I've developed pneumonia, I'm in the hospital, I'm very sick, now I'm never going to be able to breathe again, that's not true. You know, if you recover fully from the pneumonia, you can recover fully. But things like smoking that permanently damage the alveoli, that's never going to come back.
That's a chronic insult.
That's not a chronic insult, right.
This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and our topic tonight, winter-related illnesses as well as influenza awareness. We have three excellent guests tonight. We have Dr. Joseph Bocchini from Louisiana State University School of Medicine. He is a pediatric infectious disease specialist, also the chairman of the Department of Pediatrics. We have an adult infectious disease specialist, Dr. Raymond Coughlin, as well as an adult pulmonary and critical care specialist, Dr. Himanshu Desai. The number again is 1-800-552-8502. We have a caller from way out in Cross Lake, Randall from Cross Lake. Apparently, it's become its own location here on Health Matters. Let's hear from Randall.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Great show tonight and great guest. I'm curious as to how effective the flu vaccine is. You oftentimes hear that that some years it's more effective than other years. So I'd like to know a little bit more about why that is, and I'll hang up and listen.
Randall, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Bocchini, what's up with the flu vaccine? We hear every year it's good this year, it's not so good this year. Why is it different?
So one of the things that's really important about influenza is that the virus continues to change. There are mutations in the virus, and as the virus changes, your ability to fight the infection based on a previous infection diminishes. And so when we make a vaccine, when a vaccine is made each year, it's made to try and match the strains of influenza that are expected to circulate that influenza season. So the vaccine that's being used this year, the decision to as to what strains of influenza that needed to be in the vaccine were made based on the types of vaccine, the types of viruses that were circulating in the southern hemisphere in the winter. So by February, they had to make a decision so that they could grow enough virus to make the vaccine. So if the virus doesn't change by the time it gets to the northern hemisphere, then the vaccine is well matched to the viruses, and then you get reasonable effectiveness. If the vaccine, if the virus has mutated and now it's different than the vaccine, then the vaccine isn't going to work so well. So on a good year, a healthy individual who gets influenza vaccine, the vaccine probably prevents about 70% of influenza infections. If you are older or have underlying illnesses that may diminish the immune response to the vaccine, it may not be as effective in a good year as that 70%, maybe down to 50%. But that is much better than not having any vaccine, because even the people who have diminished protection, they may have some effectiveness of the vaccine. So it may not prevent all the complications of influenza, but it may make a milder disease out of influenza. So on a good year, the vaccine is going to be very effective. On a year that isn't matched very well, which happened 2 years ago, we had a vaccine that was made, and the predominant strain of influenza was an H3N2 influenza. It had mutated before the season started, and the vaccine effectiveness against that strain was only 15%. So there are a number of things that go into effectiveness. One is whether the viruses are matched, and two, the type of response an individual can produce based on underlying conditions and age.
And just for my own edification, do the individuals in the southern hemisphere basically get exposed to the influenza virus naively, or is there a reciprocal process in which the vaccine is developed for them, and sort of we're exchanging information continuously around the globe as the planet orbits?
Yeah, so influenza continues to circulate throughout the entire year. And so in the southern hemisphere, their winter is during our summer.
Right.
And so during their winter season, they have influenza. And because of the fact that the virus continues to be transmitted amongst people, it has the opportunity to mutate and change. But then those same viruses during our winter now make it back to the northern hemisphere. So influenza is active throughout the world all year, depending on who has experience in their winter season. So it's the same viruses that continue to change because they continue to circulate.
All right. Excellent answer to Randall's question. Randall, thank you so much for calling us tonight. You know, another question that comes up, an individual who has the flu, who's had the flu this season, do they have protection from, number one, getting the flu again this year? Let's say they have it early in October or November. Are they protected for this cycle? And do they have more permanent immunity for years in the future?
So I'll start that, and then I'm sure Ray may want to weigh in as well. As the influenza virus changes genetically and it mutates, the protection that you have from an individual infection is best against the virus that you responded to. So as that virus changes, you may not have as much protection. And if there's a major change in the virus, then you may have no protection. And in addition to that, each year we now have two different influenza A viruses that continue to circulate and two B viruses that circulate. So your chance of getting influenza each year with a different virus strain that you have no protection to is pretty real. And that's why we recommend you get an influenza vaccine every year, because you cannot guarantee that the virus is going to be like the previous ones, so you may not have any protection.
So the flu I get this year could be completely unrelated and have no protection for the flu that's circulating next year.
That's correct.
Dr. Coughlin.
I have very little to add to that, really, in the sense that with the changes in it, it's a virus, again, it's not a bacteria, so we see a mutation or a change in that virus quite frequently. So that's why we don't have a single vaccine once and for all. I mean, why we need the vaccine every year. The immune system is interesting in itself in that it may not be that we have no protection from the next year's virus, but or the change in the virus that we. That's why we encourage people to take it annually, because each time we are immunized or vaccinated, then we may build more protection in our immune system for any pandemic virus, which I hate to actually mention, but a pandemic, a bizarre mutation, let's say, of the virus. We think that getting annually immunized or vaccinated will help to some degree with that as well, should that happen. We've had three pandemics in the 20th century, and we're not really looking forward to any more. And when people think of pandemic, they go back to 1918, when something like 600,000-700,000 Americans died from that strain of the flu. So it's, once again, it can be an extremely dangerous viral infection that we have every means to protect ourselves from, and encourage everybody to do so.
Again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The number for your questions, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Laura from Shreveport. Laura, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi.
Hello. Laura, what's your question?
So my question is, I'm not a fan of shots. Is there another option for people like me? I know they offer the FluMist for children, but is it valid for adults?
That's a good question. Let's go ahead and put this out to the panel and see. Dr. Desai, have you encountered patients that are a little bit squeamish of needles who would like to try the FluMist as an adult?
We give the flu shot at our office, and we do have a few patients that are squeamish from the shot, but the needle's really not that bad, and it's small little needle stick. We don't even offer the FluMist for adults in our office.
So this year, FluMist, the nasal spray vaccine, is not recommended by the CDC or the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the reason is that for the past 3 years, for some reason that's not known, the FluMist vaccine has not been very effective. So until that's worked out by the manufacturers and agreed upon by the FDA and the CDC, the recommendation this year is only for the injection. And as Dr. Desai said, even for people who are afraid of needles, this is not a very painful injection, and we certainly would recommend that those people who wanted a nasal spray and find that it's not available should get the injection. It's really not that bad, and it offers significant protection. So, and the hope is that FluMist will come back, that they'll figure out what the problem is and make it available. It's certainly something that we would like to have as an alternative, but this year it's just not going to be available.
All right, Laura, that was a good question. Thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight. Let's go to our next caller. We're going to talk to Anna from Shreveport. Anna, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi, thank you. Okay, so my question is, I thought it was really interesting about what the doctor was talking about, the epidemic, the pandemic of 1918. So my husband is very anti-flu shot. I've been getting the flu shot since high school when I first got the flu for the first time. He's never had the flu shot in his entire life. And his argument against it is that there is no research that shows that getting the flu vaccine every year will build up your immune system to help you protect against a situation like a pandemic. Is there any article out there that I can email him or show him to kind of push him toward getting the flu shot?
Thank you. Thank you so much for that question. We have a denier in the population, so let's put it to our academic panelists here.
Well, I think there is much literature that suggests that we can protect ourselves from the flu from influenza with immunization, but your question about the paper, if you just went to cdc.org/influenza, I think you might find some information there that may help you to change the mind of your husband, but I'm also married, and I know that's not always possible.
Well, Dr. Bocchini, I was actually discussing this with a parent recently, and there was a discrepancy between one parent and the other in terms of whether or not to vaccinate a child. And so an adult is a responsible individual. They can make their own decisions. But what do you tell parents who have a difference of opinion about both the benefit of the vaccine, which Anna describes, or actually the risk, right? The adverse effects potentially of a vaccine, which obviously in medicine, the first thing we learn is first do no harm. So the risk of benefit versus the risk of actually an adverse event from the vaccine.
Well, the first thing is that we've been giving influenza vaccine for many, many years, and the evidence is it is very safe. So it's the safety of influenza vaccines has been well established. So I don't think we need to worry about any common serious side effects of influenza vaccine. It's a very safe vaccine. Number two, for children, young children who have influenza have as much of a risk of being hospitalized with complications of influenza as adults 65 years of age and older.
And this is children underlying health problems.
This is children who are otherwise healthy, who are under 2 years of age. They are on particular flu seasons, because it changes from year to year, but for many flu seasons, their hospitalization rate is the same as or sometimes even greater than adults 65 years of age and older. Predominantly because they may be getting their first influenza infection, because they're smaller, their airways are smaller, and so the risk of the inflammation getting down to their lower airway and causing a lower respiratory tract infection is high. So it's important that parents recognize that it can be a dangerous disease for young children. And actually each year, although most of the influenza deaths in the United States are in adults, anywhere from 85 to 300 children have died of influenza every winter for the past 5 or 6 years. And the vast majority of the children who die of influenza have no underlying risk factors that we know, and they're mostly unvaccinated. So I think we've got lots of evidence that this is not only a vaccine-preventable disease, but it's serious enough in children that we need to protect them each year. And then let me just make one other comment. Influenza is also a very serious disease for pregnant women. And it's serious enough that it is recommended that any woman who is pregnant or will be pregnant during the influenza season get influenza vaccine. It protects them from the complications of influenza. I'm sure Dr. Desai may have seen an adult pregnant woman who ends up in the hospital in the intensive care unit because of influenza. And actually, we now have data that if we immunize the pregnant woman, not only do we protect her, but there's enough antibody that's transmitted to her baby in utero that the baby is protected at a very young age against getting influenza, and they're in a young age where we cannot give them influenza vaccine. So we get benefit both for the mom and the baby by immunizing mothers against influenza.
It brings up an interesting question. Let's say we have a mother who's learns of a pregnancy in January, February, and they're going to deliver in flu season. Is the vaccine indicated prophylactically for the child you know, prior to delivery, even if, you know, specifically for that reason.
Well, the primary reason for giving the vaccine would be to prevent the mother from having complications of influenza.
Sure.
And then the side benefit is that if it's early enough in the pregnancy where the mother develops a good, strong antibody response, and that antibody crosses the placenta to the baby, then we get an extra benefit for the infant. So
anytime during
flu season, if she has not had the vaccine, it's a good time to get it.
And if I might just say one more thing, that if the mother's breastfeeding, that also helps the child to transfer at that age, to transfer the immunity to the child.
Yeah, so you know, Dr. Bucchini was mentioning it's 6 months and older, and so a mother who is breastfeeding an infant that's less than 6 months is basically vaccinating the child.
Right.
As well. All right, let's talk to Craig from Shreveport. Craig, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes. I was just wondering if there is any age group or demographic that you would say does not necessarily need the vaccine. As for myself, I've never gotten it, and I never catch the flu. I'm a very healthy individual. I'm just curious if anyone does not necessarily need it that you would say.
I would suggest that there is not such a demographic. That everyone, I think, not being hit by a truck doesn't suggest that, you know, we should run across the road with several 18-wheelers coming down it. But at the same time, I think that it again, there's no such demographic that would suggest that your immune system is is superb to the general population, and therefore you wouldn't need to be immunized. I must say that, you know, we've gotten rid of smallpox. We're trying to get rid of influenza, but it's it changes so quickly every year that it's quite difficult.
I haven't been really sick with the flu since I was in high school, and I'm 37 now, so that's part of the reason why I brought it up, because it sounds everyone should get the vaccine, but I don't know. I just feel like I don't need it.
Well, you know, I think it's a general rule that most people do recover from the flu. It's the small proportion of people who, you know, have a severe form of the infection. And honestly, I think there are a lot of us, and I've been guilty of this myself, who get a free ride because most people around us, I work in the healthcare profession, most people around me are vaccinated. And so they're not getting the flu, and so I'm probably not being exposed to it. And so there is the possibility that a number of us who are not being vaccinated are benefiting from those who are. And so I would advocate that, you know, we get on the good side of the equation and, you know, don't take that risk of getting the flu. And then, Dr. Bucchini, let's say I'm exposed to the flu. Before I get symptoms, am I actually at risk for transmitting the flu before I even know that I'm sick to others who may not have been vaccinated, even to small children? Let's say I have nieces, nephews, children, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the evidence is that you can spread influenza. You are infectious for a day or more prior to you developing influenza symptoms. So you can spread it before you become ill. The other thing I'd say about this is that even though you are healthy, you have parents, you have may have grandparents, you're exposed to young children, maybe pregnant women. So not only does the influenza vaccine protect you, but as Dr. Brewer said, if you're around other people that haven't been immunized and you have influenza, you may transmit it to those who have high risk. It's important not only to get influenza vaccine for yourself, but to protect those around you who may be at higher risk.
To piggyback on that, this young gentleman said he's 37 and he's healthy and he's never been sick. Well, at 37, if you do develop the flu, chances are you'll have upper respiratory type symptoms, maybe a light fever, some malaise, and you may just go on with your normal day because you have a good athletic build and you're healthy. But as Dr. Bocchini said, your parents that you're around, your children that you're around, other young people that you're around may not be so lucky to be able to fight off that, that subclinical infection that you're spreading.
Let's say, for example, Craig does get the flu and his family have not been vaccinated and he's quite sick and needs to, you know, be taken care of, needs to stay home from work for a few days. Is there a window of time that they would need to maybe get the shot before they would need to wait to be exposed to him? Or, you know, is it, you know, if you know someone has the flu, what's the window of time in terms of after you get the vaccine that it's going to be effective in prevention? How long does it take to work, basically?
If you're immunized,
right,
it's around 2 weeks to mount a response to prevent you from getting the flu. So those who say, I got the flu 4 days after, and I know this is not to the question, 4 days after I got the vaccine, the shot, the flu shot, then you could possibly get the flu. But you don't get the flu from the influenza shot. There is no infectivity there whatsoever. Back to the question, you would not immunize the rest of your family now that you know that you have the flu. Hopefully the person who's diagnosed you as having the flu will recognize that yesterday or the day before you didn't have it, today you have it, and therefore there's therapy that you can take. And so there are antiviral drugs about that, if it's recognized within a couple of days, that you should take or be given. Recognizing that you have a wife and two children at home and now you have influenza, those same, depending on the age of the child, those two, the antiviral drugs should be given to them as prophylaxis. Prophylaxis meaning, again, to try and avoid or prevent the infection from spreading. And the dosing is longer for prophylaxis. It's 10 days worth of drug versus 5 days for the person that has the influenza.
Well, let's say we have coworkers out there and they haven't gotten their flu vaccine yet, and this is a segue, a question asked over the internet. You know, how close to the start of the flu season should we actually, you know, get the flu shot? But also, let's say I show up to work tomorrow and the guy that I sit next to at work called in sick, says, oh, the boss says, well, he may have the flu, so he's staying home today. Well, should I, and I haven't gotten my flu shot, should I go get on the medicine? Should I go get the flu shot? Or should I just cross my fingers and hope that everything works out for the best? Dr. Bocchini.
Well, right now I'd say go get the flu shot.
Yeah.
We're at the beginning of the influenza season. And actually, around the country, there have been some sporadic cases of influenza. In Louisiana, we've had a couple of sporadic cases as well. And so if someone has a respiratory illness now, it is much more likely not to be influenza than influenza. So this is a really good time to get the vaccine. You can start getting the vaccine when it becomes available. So September, October, reasonable time. I think, I don't know, Ray, whether you're asking for older adults to wait a little bit longer or not, but I think that the key issue is that if you get vaccinated in September and October or even November, before the influenza season begins, you should be protected throughout the entire season.
You're not going to run out of protection.
You will not run out of protection.
Okay.
You will not.
But
yeah.
No such thing as getting it too early. Right. You're not going to run out
of
protection.
Well, since the
one potential exception.
The vaccine, when the vaccines can be available, as many people recognize that many of the drugstores had vaccine in August, and but it, if you're, we say older, we've picked 65 as our age you get older after you get 65. But anyway, if in fact, as Dr. Bocchini mentioned earlier, your immune system is not as primed as easily after 65 as it is when you're 40. And so it's thought that in an adult that you should wait until the end of September, the beginning of October. And again, there was some question about whether in fact you should get a second dose in the elderly or the immune compromised, but there is no real supporting data for that. That usually think a single dose is good enough.
So let me just add one thing, is that there are many different formulations of influenza vaccine available now, and there is what is called a high-dose formulation for 65 years of age and older. And certainly, I think it's a reasonable recommendation that if high dose is available and you're 65 or older, that you choose the high-dose vaccine. There is evidence that it offers a little more protection than the standard dose.
Mike, thank you so much for your patience. Mike from Lufton, you're on Health Matters tonight.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask about what's the significance of having an allergy to eggs as a contraindication to getting the flu shot?
Our guests are thanking you for your question as you speak. So, Dr. Bocchini.
So first, from a pediatric perspective, the evidence now is that egg allergy is no longer a contraindication to influenza vaccine. Anybody with an egg allergy, even a severe egg allergy, can receive influenza vaccine, and this goes for children. And for adults, there are other preparations that some people might choose. But for anybody with an egg allergy, it is now known to be safe to be given influenza vaccine. It's no longer a contraindication.
As Dr. Bocchini said, that's true for all ages.
Mike, great question. Thank you so much for calling and asking that. Let's talk to Dave from Shreveport. Dave, you're on Health Matters.
Excellent. Enjoyed the program. I know the time is short, so I'll cut right to the chase. My wife is in healthcare. She's a nurse at an assisted living facility, where she seems to be the sickest person there. She catches everything that comes down the pike. Last year, she got the flu shot, came down with the flu twice afterwards. Is there anything other than getting plenty of rest and eating right and getting exercise that she can do to build up her immune system? She is a constant hand washer. I never wash my hands. I mean, that's both exaggerations, but she is way sicker than I ever am. What are your thoughts?
Dave, that's a great question. Thank you so much for calling and asking that. Dr. Desai, we haven't heard from you in a few moments.
I think what your wife is doing is the right thing. Unfortunately, she's in a high-risk situation, in a high-risk job where you can be exposed to numerous type of pathogens there. Again, wash your hands. Use alcohol-based gels to help clean your hands. Avoid crowds. Cover your coughs and sneezes. Avoid people that are coughing and sneezing if you can, and avoid handshakes. I stopped handshaking my patients now because you never know what they're transmitting.
So you're the unfriendly one.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, and we really appreciate your call and support of the show. Dr. Coughlin, are there situations in which you would recommend extra precautions in healthcare providers in terms of either lifestyle or vaccinations, whether it's the influenza vaccine or the pneumococcal vaccine or the meningococcal vaccine? We haven't gotten, into the total, list of recommendations in terms of adult vaccinations. But just in the last 60 seconds or so, healthcare workers, what should they do in addition, if anything, to what Dr. Desai has mentioned?
I think this is just an opinion. Is that
if this there's level five recommendation?
If there's a vaccine available, make yourself available. Mm-hmm. As there is, we're trying to stay healthy. We wash our hands. Back to your question: if you're in an environment such as a healthcare or hospital environment. To Dr. Bocchini's point, you've got to consider protecting yourself, your family at home, and your family in the hospital. And there are very few people who have complete contraindication to the vaccine. So more importantly than anything else, it's my suggestion that every healthcare worker should be immunized with at least the influenza vaccine. I think for years we have charted pediatric vaccines well. I think we're finally getting into, at least in the hospital and in doctor's offices, where we are documenting, or we're going to document, adult immunizations better. And I believe we have another caller.
Yeah, thank you so much for announcing Sally from Texas. Sally, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
My question is, over 20 years, my question is, over a 20-year period, I have had two pneumonia shots. I have COPD, and I'm wondering if I need to get another pneumonia shot.
Sally, that's a great question. We're going to get Dr. Desai to answer that here in the last couple of seconds.
I'm glad you brought that up, Sally, because we've talked about the flu pretty extensively in the flu vaccine, but we haven't talked about the pneumonia shot and the pneumonia vaccine. There are two pneumonia vaccines that are available, and for a patient like you with COPD, you should be getting both of those pneumonia vaccines. The first one is the Pneumovax, and that should be given approximately every 5 years for you. And then the next one is the Prevnar at a maximum of two of those. And the next one is the Prevnar 13, which you should get one time, and you don't need revaccination for that. But both those vaccines are recommended for all adults over the age of 65, and especially for adults in high risk between 19 and 65 with pre-existing lung conditions like COPD, asthma, cystic fibrosis, diabetes, cerebral spinal fluid leak, cochlear implants, BMI greater than 40. These vaccines are both recommended, and I'm glad you brought that up. So for your specific case, you don't need the Pneumovax again since you've had two of those already, but if you've not had the Prevnar 13, you do need to get that as well.
Thank you, Dr. Desai. Also, thank you to Dr. Raymond Coughlin, and thanks always to Dr. Joseph Bocchini from LSU here in Shreveport. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. Views are on Health Matters do not reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. You can download this presentation after we are finished from redriverradio.org. The producer here is Renee Moran, with assistance tonight from Wally Derleth, Tim Snell, and Al Villarreal. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation, also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for our Mental Health Matters edition. The topic will be gratitude. And I thank all of our callers tonight for their excellent questions. It's been quite a hopefully informative discussion.